Thank you very much. I'm very grateful to Jewish Socialist Group for inviting me. I'm slightly nervous because I feel that at least David and probably some of you probably know more than I do about this. And I also want to apologise for... I'm going to read some of this off my screen because I did what I always did and left my notes in the printer after I printed them out. So I hate people who read things off computer screens, but... So apologies for that. What I'm going to do is I'm just going to say a little bit about the garment industry in this part of London and in the West End at the time of the 1912 strike. I'll give a very brief history of the kind of trade union movement in the garment industry leading up to the strike. Say something about the story of the strike itself and then a couple of kind of conclusions. And I think Donica's going to talk a bit more about the kind of historiography and significance of the event. In terms of the garment industry, this part of London, as you all know, was one of the main places of arrival for Jewish workers from Eastern Europe, who found a kind of ready niche in London's labour market in industries like the garment industry, and had done from the early 19th century, and there are some examples going back to the late medieval period of Jewish garment workers in this part of London, on the kind of eastern edge of the city, of the walls of the city of London. Jews worked in second-hand clothes business, and particularly in the kind of cheap end of the clothes market. But the garment industry in this area had been thriving for much longer and was not just a Jewish trade. It had employed male and female labour from East End workers, but also from migrants from the English countryside and from Ireland who came to this part of London working in those kind of clothes trades that were associated with serving the city of London. When Jews came here first as kind of trickle in the 18 from Eastern Europe from the 1860s and then in bigger numbers from the 1880s, they found easy points of access into the garment industry, into similar industries, furniture making, shoemaking, and other industries that were characterised by a kind of subdivision of labour, subcontracting, and division of tasks. And I think that there's a number of reasons why this was. I think that family and hometown, landslide connections were very easy to kind of exploit and mobilise in getting people jobs in these kind of industries. The way that you got a job was often through word of mouth, through someone you had a family or family-like connection with. The linguistic barriers that the migrants had of not speaking English when they arrived prevented them finding jobs in the wider labour market, and so often their entry into the labour market was mediated by Jewish entrepreneurs who could kind of act as intermediaries between the English-speaking manufacturers and sellers of garments and the Yiddish-speaking workers in the East End. The point at which the Jews from Eastern Europe started arriving in large numbers in this part of London coincided with a big explosion in the clothes industry, particularly because of the rise of the West End department stores, and kind of fed by kind of growth of consumer culture and the sewing machine, which was introduced in 1851, the mechanical sewing machine. And so the department stores, manufacturers mainly in the West End, were able to kind of reduce their costs by kind of basically passing the costs on to the immigrant workers who worked at home in the East End. So if the immigrants bought their own sewing machines, that was a cost that the manufacturers were able to defray. And London rents, which were always high, encouraged this. The rents were slightly cheaper here. So again, it was a way of cutting costs for the big wholesalers and retailers. And I guess so there was a kind of an intimacy between the consumption, the glittery consumption that was growing at that time in the West End and the labour of people in the East End. Clementina Black, who was a kind of the activist against the sweated industry, she said, "The spectre of sweating haunts not only the fevered ends of the slums, but is present in the most costly garments of the fashionable West End shops, in the rich embroideries of the wealthy, as well as the household matchbox." It was a kind of recognition from activists that the kind of conspicuous consumption of the West End was based on the sweat of home workers mainly in this part of London. The proximity of the docks was also important. It was the point of arrival for migrants, but it was also a kind of key in the circulation of a lot of the clothing industry. This area served as well as the West End trade, served an imperial trade. There were smaller department stores around the empire, and also what was known as the kaffir trade, which was garments made for black workers in African colonies, particularly South Africa. And a really large percentage of the clothes that were made in sweatshops in this part of London were actually exported to the colonies, in particular South Africa. And many of the textiles that were used were also manufactured in the colonies, particularly in the Indian Empire, especially in Bengal, that were again arrived at the docks in East London. So the kind of proximity to the docks is an important part of the story. By 1912, the East End garment industry was dominated by Jewish immigrant workers, or there were still non-Jewish workers, male and female workers, more or less equal numbers at that time, both large and small enterprises. In all of those, hours were long. The main bits of the trade that were served in the, that were based in the East End was the ready-made women's clothing trade, so ready-made clothes that was sold straight to wholesalers or shops. But there was also some quality kind of bespoke tailoring that was done here, where the measuring was often done in the City of London and then the making was done in the East End. There were about 1,000 garment workshops in the East End at that time. They made the suits for the expanding white-collar clerical workforce in the City of London. They made the uniforms of the military in Boer War and subsequently, and they made, you know, smart dresses for ladies who shopped. It was quite a varied industry. Wages varied too from year to year and from month to month, depended a lot on the season and on the fashions. But there were rarely more in the 1910s than £1 a week, and men earned roughly twice what women earned. In the West End, there was about 6,000 workers in 1901, and it went up a bit. It was higher than that by the time of the 1912 strike. And in the West End, it was overwhelmingly small-scale enterprise concentrated in men's tailoring. The bespoke trade was based in the West End. But there was quite a variation in quality, in skill, and in pay. So, you know, Savile Row at the top end, but around Frith Street, there were lots of kind of low-end tailoring workshops where the pay was much lower. This lower end of the trade in the West End was declining in the 1900s and 1910s, and what was replacing it, as well as the East End trade, was some kind of wholesale manufacturing linked directly to the department stores, usually kind of behind Oxford Street in the bits that the shoppers didn't see. And there's a very steep hierarchy of pay and of occupations in the West End. So the cutters at the top earned about £2 a week. Needlewomen at the bottom earned about 5 shillings. So it's a big range in pay. This industry was, I guess, very hard to unionise. There were a number of efforts in both the East End and the West End from the 1870s onwards amongst the Jewish workers, and there have been efforts amongst the non-Jewish workers earlier. And there's a number of reasons why it was very difficult to unionise. The complex kind of pattern of subdivisions was one of the key reasons. So different workers in different enterprises had very specialised activities and were often trained just for one skill. So they were very easy to train, easy to replace, easy to sack. The mass immigration, as well as continuing mass immigration from the countryside, helped create an enormous pool of people wanting work, so there were always new workers hungry to fill the places of striking or sacked workers. Within the Jewish sector, that, as I said, exploitation was kind of also eased by the mobilisation of family ties, so it was often your kind of cousin or uncle that was perhaps your immediate employer. Getting a job, getting promoted, was also often done through kind of system of favour and patronage in which family and hometown played a big role. I think the subdivisional and subcontracting system as well, because it was based on piecework, you were paid on what you produced rather than the hours you worked, meant that profit margins at the bottom of the supply chain were small. So masters at the bottom end of the market were often little better off than their employees, had very small profit margins, were very unwilling to kind of budge on pay. But it also meant that workers kind of had more, I think, entrepreneurial aspirations, in that becoming a master was within sight. So you didn't actually need that much capital to shift from being an employee to being self-employed. And I think this was probably a block on class consciousness. But certainly Rudolf Rocker, the anarchist leader, believed that that was the case. The piecework system, subdivisions, also meant that workers were very isolated if they worked in a small workshop, or particularly if they worked at home. And so the kind of on-the-job sociality that you get in bigger industries was made trade unionism hard to sustain. And long hours meant people were just too tired. And I think a lot of these characteristics were not just the case in the garment industry, but also in many other London industries. London's industries in general, typified by this kind of very complex subdivisions and small kind of subcategories of work. Nonetheless, from 1870s, there were a number of efforts to organise the Jewish workers. 1872, 1876, 1883, the three kind of iconic short-lived attempts. Most of the Jewish workers in this area were Polish, and the first couple of attempts were led by Lithuanian workers. And in Bill Fishman's story, they were called the Brill of the Spectacles. They were the kind of seen as the Lithuanian intellectuals, and seen as kind of too good, acting too good for themselves. There was a strong kind of ideology, the trade unions at this time, that trade unions were basically about propaganda for socialism, that the kind of iron laws of capitalism weren't going to be stopped by trade unions. The early both anarchists and social democrats in the unions, this is typical, trade unions alone cannot end the wretched life of the worker, and they lead workers off the right road with their belief in self-help. So there was a kind of downgrading of trade unionism in the Jewish socialist movement. However, I think this changed really with the 1880s and the new unionism. I'm sure you know the story, the match girls, the dockers, struggles that people like Annie Besant, Eleanor Marx were involved in, John Bones and Tom Mann. Particularly in the across the UK, especially in London, particularly in the East End of London, some of the most unskilled, casualised trades kind of broke out in massive strikes through the 1888-1889, and most of these were had significant successes. Some of the features of this time were repeated in 1912. There was solidarity across trades and across ethnicities. People learnt from what was going on in other trades and sectors. There were examples of different unions helping each other out. The dockers managed to raise thousands of pounds from donations. The tailors were only able to raise hundreds. And the dockers, while they were striking, gave a £100 donation to the tailors, which was quite significant at the time. So there were examples of kind of solidarity across different lines. There were a number of socialists and anarchists active in the Socialist League and the Social Democratic Federation. Wolf Fess, who was one of the main Jewish tailors leaders, was in the Socialist League, the more libertarian, two main socialist parties. Lewis Lyons, who was another tailors leader, was in the Social Democratic Federation. And so there was the play of kind of socialist ideology within the scene. And significantly, there was an alliance between the West End and the East End tailors as well. And they struck at the same time. In the wake of the 1880s moment, I guess there was the period when the rise of anarchism in the Jewish East End. Wolf Fess, as I said, was one of the tailors' leaders, was a key figure in this time, translating key anarchist works into Yiddish. There was a kind of flourishing Yiddish anarchist press. And then I guess most of you are familiar with the kind of iconic figure of Rudolf Rocker, a non-Jewish German anarchist activist who arrived in the 1890s and came into contact with the East End Jewish anarchist scene, and kind of became a key figure in it. It's time the Jubilee Street Club and Sydney Street, the revival of the Workers' Friend, Arbeiter Friends, and Germanal, the literary journal movement. So I said before that some of the earlier Jewish radicals, both socialists and anarchists, had downgraded trade union activity. In the 1900s, the circle around Rudolf Rocker became increasingly interested in trade union activity. and saw trade union struggle as central to socialist struggle, and trade unions as a kind of microcosm of a socialist society. Rocker rejected the belief that was shared by both orthodox Marxists and many classical anarchists, that the kind of jam tomorrow is more important than bread today. And he pinpointed in his memoirs, he pinpointed his expeditions to his early encounter with poverty in the East End. He said was the point at which he realised that the kind of socialist utopia that will never come was less important than kind of getting people out of poverty in the here and now. He said, I saw with my own eyes thousands of human beings who could hardly be still considered such. And his faith that kind of revolution was the solution was kind of shaken by this. Him and his circle were very influential in the 1904 Baker's Strike. There's a Jewish Socialist pamphlet you should buy about it if you haven't, which was a small victory for the trade unions at the time. And then the 1906 Taylor's Strike, which ended in defeat after the employers locked the strikers out for a while. The 1906 strike, although it was a defeat for the trade unionists, was important as a kind of learning experience for the anarchists and for the trade unionists. The anarchists played a major role in organising the union and in organising the solidarity from the community at large for the strikers. And so Bill Fishman in his history talks, based on oral history interviews, of a continuous flow of donors, mostly shawled housewives bringing bagels, brown herring, fruits and homemade gefilte fish and fried fish to feed the strikers. I think these food references, kind of gefilte fish references, I don't know whether Bill Fishman is particularly obsessed with gefilte fish or all of his oral history accounts actually feature them, because he has a lot of gefilte fish stories. But I think this is kind of significant about the way in which the strikes were able to mobilise a wider community support beyond the kind of ideological anarchist milieu. And that they were able to draw on the kind of Yiddish folk culture. I think it was kind of a space of translation between the syndicalist theory that they were publishing in their newspapers and the kind of popular culture of the Yiddish-speaking working class in the East End. And he also, and it's not just Fishman, but other accounts too, stress the fact that during this period in the 1900s, that religious Jews who were very opposed to many of the tenets of that kind of anarchist ideology also became drawn to the movement, got involved in the strike. Jeffrey Alderman in his historical work said there was not merely no conflict between praying in a synagogue and then sitting in the same room to discuss socialist principles and organise industrial stoppages. It was the norm. And Joseph Lefkowitz also talks about that. Talks about a Whitechapel strike meeting where the bulk of the audience was Orthodox, went home after the meeting to their back rooms and garrets to recite the Song of Solomon. At this same period, in the kind of English-speaking working class, the same ideas that Rocker was interested in were also kind of growing within the wider trade union movement. Tom Mann was a key figure in that. He'd been involved in the Dockers' strikes of 1880, emigrated to Australia in 1901, returned to Britain in 1910. The first job that he got when he came back was as an organiser on the docks in the East End. He visited France, where he met with the CGT, who were a syndicalist union, who had recently kind of published their charter, which rejected a parliamentary road to socialism and saw the trade union as the main road to socialism. Founded the Industrial Syndicalist Education League at that time, and was involved in syndicalist publication later that year. Donna's going to talk more about that. Another important publication wasn't involved in, directly involved in, was the Miners Next Set, which is a publication of the South Wales Miners, which kind of spread this kind of syndicalist ideas throughout the working class. Another significant moment as well, an open letter to British soldiers pamphlet, I think written by Irish syndicalists, but first circulated in the Irish syndicalist, Irish Worker, right? Newspaper, and then in the Liverpool strike. And Tom Mann and a couple of other people were imprisoned under very old anti-sedition laws for distributing it, calling upon soldiers not to fire upon striking workers. The period saw a strike wave starting in late 1909, kind of growing through 1910 into 1911 across several different industries. And this movement was followed very closely in the Yiddish anarchist press and the Yiddish workers' press in general, particularly the anarchist press. And it was particularly the unskilled trades and some of the most casualized trades, as in the 1880s, that were most militant. In Liverpool, troops were brought to suppress the striking transport workers, firing on the crowd and killing two. The kind of movement came to East London, autumn 1911, with the first unsuccessful dockers' strike. They demanded a wage increase of 2 pence an hour, improved condition, and crucially recognition for unions, formal recognition of unions. The employers refused, and the strike was unsuccessful. Kind of inspired, I think, partly by this wave of strikes, the West End tailors went on strike in April 1912. 15,000 workers were on strike. Strike meetings were attended by up to 8,000 tailors in the West End. And the strike was basically about pay, a demand for a shift from piecework to hourly pay, for a shorter working day, and for improved wages and conditions, and as with the dockers, for union recognition. The employers, remembering their victory in 1906, thought that this would be an easy victory for them by locking out the workers in the West End. In the East End, Rocker and his circle called for solidarity strike because they were very aware, as the West End tailors leaders were very aware, that the employers would bring the work to the East End, get things either finished or done in the East End, and undercut the West End strike. Only if the East End industry also went on strike would the West End strike have any chance of success. A mass meeting at Great Assembly Hall on Mile End, which I think was one of the biggest capacity venues in this area, temperance, kind of Christian temperance mission, something like 8,000 people inside, and in varying different accounts, possibly as many people outside, voted overwhelmingly to join Solidarity Strike. 13,000 workers in the East End quit their jobs, so doubling the number of people on strike. So the demands now were for a 9.5-hour day. That's 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. with an hour for lunch and half an hour for tea, and for wages based on this. On the hours. The Bakers Union, the Cigarette Workers Union, gave free supplies. Other unions brought in voluntary levy on their weekly wage to support. The Yiddish Theatre put on benefit performances. There were constant open-air meetings, including joint meetings of the East and West End workers at Tower Hill. The anarchists, Rocker and his colleagues, Yakov Kaplan was also another key anarchist activist in this, played a major role. The Arbeiter Friend went to a daily, was produced daily during this time as a kind of four-page strike bulletin. After 3 weeks, so there was strike pay in the first week. They couldn't keep the funds up to keep that going into the second, and then third week when the strike was still going, and the West End workers reached a settlement with the employers. The masters basically gave in to all of the conditions with the exception of unionisation, of kind of union closed shop, which was one of the demands of the workers. At the Pavilion Theatre on the Whitechapel High Street, the East End workers held a meeting to decide whether to also to accept the masters' offer. Rocker advised them that a closed shop was a kind of key demand, that was non-negotiable, that without that the giving in to the other demands were meaningless. Although people had been unpaid for 2 weeks and barely able to kind of survive hand to mouth, they overwhelmingly voted to remain on strike, and the next day the employers caved in and accepted all of the demands. The shops that went back to work one by one, only when they kind of agreed to union recognition, and the shops that kind of that held out against union recognition longest were boycotted by the workers, and some of them went under. As a kind of coda to the strike, so I'm using up my time, as the tailors' strike was ending, the dockers went back on strike. The numbers, I've stolen that from the internet, as you can see by the watermark. What was significant about the tailors' strike, it was very similar sorts of demands, union recognition, hours, hourly pay, and kind of less casualised system. But the tailors' leaders, including Rocker, were very active, speaking at the meeting of the dockers. And there were joint meetings during the period when the two strikes overlapped. There were joint meetings at Mile End Waste of the two strikes. And one of the most significant things was that the tailors, who'd just gone back to work, agreed to take in the children of striking dockers. And something like 200 to 300 dockers' children, mainly from Catholic families, were taken in, but kind of temporarily adopted by mainly Jewish tailoring families in that period. So I just want to conclude, two kind of comments to conclude with before I hand over. And one is about, is to kind of reiterate the point I made about the kind of translation between the politics of socialism and syndicalism and the kind of popular culture of the Jewish working class. And this phrase, Taka Agoya Baramensch, is from Rocker's memoirs. He talks about, at the end of the strike, a kind of ultra-Orthodox old Jewish man coming up to him and saying, basically it means, you may be a goy, you may not be a Jew, but you're a mensch, you're a kind of, a decent man. And kind of Rocker talks about this, I think, as a kind of symbolising the fact, the trust that the anarchists had won with the religious Jews, which was a marked contrast to the 19th century when, the time of the Yom Kippur Wars, when there was a lot of tension between the religious and the socialist. Rocker did a number of things to kind of make this, to keep this going. For example, he got his partner's father, who was a religious Jew with kind of very, long beard, he always put him on the platform at strike meetings to kind of give the impression that there was kind of, religious religious people involved in the strike committee and so on. So I think this is, very significant about the politics of here and now and the kind of politics of coalition, I suppose. The other conclusion is also about the politics of coalition, which was about the significance of the joint, of the solidarity between the tailors and the dockers. And which we saw in 1880s and again in 1912. And then the other kind of key moment when it was seen was, of course, the Battle of Cable Street, when both the mainly Catholic, non-Jewish dock workers were kind of side by side with Jewish workers to beat back Mosley's fascists. And Dave can say more about this, but Bill Fishman, among others, argues that the kind of the close relationship built during that strike, particularly the temporary adoptions, the fostering of the dockers' children, was kind of key in building that kind of solidarity which was able to defeat fascism. So I'll stop there.
Thanks very much, Ben. That was great. Thank you. Fantastic, and lots of detail.